In physics, there are certain numbers that just are. They're numbers like the speed of light. We can't explain why it has that value, but it does. There are constants like pi and Planck, and we take for granted that these numbers would be the same all over the universe. But now researchers are reporting that their measurements, another of those physical constants, and those measurements known as alpha, the fine structure constant, well, that constant may not be constant after all. It's a surprising finding and definitely falls into the extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence category. But the team says that it's having trouble finding other explanations for their work, published this week in the journal Physical Review Letters. Joining me now is Michael Murphy. He is the QE2 Research Fellow in the Center for Astrophysics and Supercomputing at Swinburne University of Technology. That's in Melbourne, Australia. He's one of the authors of the paper. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Murphy.
Hi there, Ira. How are you?
Tell us what's wrong with the universe here. What did you find?
Well, we found, I guess this alpha constant that you've referred to measures really the strength of electromagnetism that we're all familiar with. Electromagnetism is probably one of the four forces of nature that most people are most familiar with, maybe apart from gravity. But that the strength of electromagnetism, as measured by alpha, seems to be different on one side of the sky and into deep space compared to the other side of the sky. So when we look in one direction, we find that it's stronger electromagnetism there, just a little bit. And then when we look in the other direction, we see that it's weaker. And so we have this kind of dipolar universe when it comes to electromagnetism, we think.
We think you think.
Yeah, well, that's what the measurements say. And as you say, we've been trying to find reasons why those measurements could be wrong. They're obviously pushing the limit of what we can do in astronomy. We're making very precise measurements using distant quasars. And as I said, we're pushing the measurements to their limit, and it's possible that some things are wrong. We haven't found any of those things. And we're opening now up by publishing these results. We're opening that debate up and up to other astronomers and other scientists.
Well, what would that mean if you're correct and it is the constant changes?
Well, the constants of nature are assumed to be constant. We don't actually know for sure that they're the constant that they are actually constant throughout the universe, and that's why we're going and doing these measurements. We actually want to test that assumption. But if they're not constant throughout the universe, then it really means that, well, our current understanding of physics, our entire understanding of physics, is really relying on those constants being constant, and that means that understanding is wrong. There's probably, therefore, a more fundamental set of laws that we have to discover, and that's exciting. That's a great opportunity. It means that our conceptual idea of the universe will completely change, and it might be that there's something like string theory or M theory or one of these what we call unification theories, something that unifies the four different forces of nature into just one theory or concept. Maybe one of those theories is correct. We don't know at this point, but they're the sort of implications we're talking about here.
How different? Your measurements? How far off are they from what you would think they are? They should be.
Well, so when we look in one part of the sky, as I said, we see a stronger value of alpha, characterizing the strength of electromagnetism, and that's greater by about 10 parts in a million on one side of the sky. And when we look to the other side of the sky, we see that it's weaker by about the same amount. And so we're not talking about large differences here, but it doesn't matter how small the change is. If there's any change at all, it really means a revolution in physics is required, in our understanding of physics is required.
Well, we've heard in the last couple of weeks two different revolutions in physics, possibly. First with the neutrino, right, going faster than the speed of light.
That's right, yes.
And now your work that shows that the measuring magnetism, electromagnetism, is different in different parts of the sky. If this is true, I mean, are there any practical applications? Of course, people like to
Well,
know.
I think the main practical result of this is that our concept of the universe would completely change. So, for example, electromagnetism is what holds you together. It's what holds atoms together. And so everything around you is really governed by electromagnetism and also subject to gravity. But if you start playing around with the strength of electromagnetism, even just by a few percent, it would turn out that, for example, carbon atoms might become unstable and water molecules might fall apart. These are the sorts of consequences of changing the strength of that electromagnetic force. And so, for example, our life obviously depends, life as we know it, depends on carbon and water. And so if you move into a universe, into a region of the universe where electromagnetism has a significantly different strength to here on Earth, then you might cease to exist. It might also mean that there's parts of the universe where life cannot exist, life at least as we know it. If you like, we're in a Goldilocks zone of the universe, a Goldilocks, very, very large Goldilocks zone, where the values of the fine structure constant is just about right for us. Of course, we're probably tuned for the fine structure constant rather than the fine structure constant being tuned for us. Of course, we're going to find ourselves in a part of the universe where things are just right. Yeah. But it might also mean that there's other regions of the universe where our sort of life just cannot exist.
You know, what's more fascinating is that the more we're learning, the less we know. You know, instead of thinking we're getting to know more about the universe, we're finding this dark energy that we don't know what it is. We're finding that maybe the electromagnetism is not the same everywhere. It seems to be more a more exciting, interesting place than just.
I'd say it's more exciting and interesting. I don't know where. I don't know if we're learning that we don't know as much as we did. We thought we did, but it's certainly an exciting time in astronomy. One of the main reasons for that is that we can do these sorts of precise measurements. So we couldn't have done these with photographic detectors and things like that. The technology in astronomy and the size of our telescopes these days really enables us to do fundamental physics that we would otherwise do in the laboratory here on Earth. We can do that sort of physics in distant galaxies, and that's how we've done these measurements. We've looked with the two of the largest telescopes in the world, the Keck telescope in Hawaii and the very large telescope, the European telescope in Chile, at all over the sky at different quasars, and investigate galaxies along the lines of sight to those quasars. And that's what actually allows us to probe the fundamental physics into deep space.
And so other people will need to recheck this, and you'll probably be rechecking this yourself.
Well, we're certainly rechecking
ourselves. Is it possible to come up with more accurate checks or other equipment, something like that?
Well, equipment's always advancing and technology is always advancing. We're certainly cross-checking this result in as many ways as we can find time to do by looking at using the same method and using the same sort of instruments. Those instruments are getting better. There's also new instruments being designed and starting to be built now for existing telescopes. And, of course, we all look forward to the new era of the extremely large telescope, not very large telescopes, but extremely large telescopes, 30-meter and 40-meter telescopes, that will be able to really nail this question with very highly stable spectrographs that can look at these distant galaxies in a lot more detail. But I think if you're to believe these results finally, if what we find in further experiments confirms what we've already found, then I think at the end game of this is that you really have to confirm this somehow in the laboratory. And there are hopes for that using very, very precise atomic clock experiments. And these things might be able to detect different values of alpha just in our solar system. As we go around the sun, we might experience a different strength of electromagnetism in the laboratory, and we just have to have precise enough measurement to find that. But we don't know yet.
But you'd then need an explanation for it, too.
Oh, you absolutely would, and that's the exciting part. The explanations have to meet the observations, and currently our current theories cannot explain this. Actually, our current theories can't even explain why the values of the value of the fine structure constant is what it is. We have no idea where this number comes from. Richard Feynman was, famously said that this is one of the greatest damn mysteries in the universe, and it is that. We just don't know where this number comes from. And if it started to vary, we wouldn't have an explanation for that either. But it would point the way, I think, to a new understanding, or the start of a new understanding of more fundamental laws of physics that we just don't have any idea about right now.
It's exciting. I love it. Thank you.
No problem.
You must hate your job, I'm sure.
Oh, it's terrible.
Thank you very much for joining us, Michael Murphy.
Thanks, Ara.
Dr. Murphy is the QE2 Research Fellow in the Center for Astrophysics and Supercomputing at the Swinburne University of Technology. That's in Melbourne, Australia, and one of the authors of the paper that appears in Physical Review Letters. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.
Politics now with our regular Friday observers, columnists David Brooks of the New York Times and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. Good to see you both.
Good to be with you.
Let's begin by staying on the subject of the economy. As we've just heard, unemployment has come down a little. For now, at least, those forecasts of a double-dip recession appear to have been wrong. The Republican Speaker of the House, John Boehner, when he was asked about a budget deal, says if Democrats offer entitlement cuts, he could see what he called room for revenue. Anybody here see any room for light at the end of this rather long tunnel? David, you first.
You know, economically, we're pretty much in a typical financial crisis. I still go back to the work of various economists who've said after financial crisis, it takes like 7 or 8 years to fully get the unemployment rate back. You've got people with a lot of debt. They don't know what their houses are worth. You got debt crisis like in Europe. You got low demand. You've got all these things. It just takes forever. And to me, the crucial question is, are we going to use this winter of recuperation to address the structural issues we just heard about? We've got the wage stagnation. I just read a very good piece by George Mason economist Arnold Kling arguing that we're going through a structural problem where a lot of white-collar workers in clerical work are now losing their that sort of job. And I ran into a CEO recently, and I was lamenting the terrible economy, and he said, fine by us. We've learned to adapt. We're becoming very productive. We're not creating jobs, but we're doing okay. And that's a sign of structural problem.
E.J.?
Well, you asked about the light at the end of the tunnel. My favorite sign, or one of them, from the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations read, because of budget cuts, the light at the end of the tunnel has been turned off. And I think when you look at these numbers, they are not encouraging at all. There are structural problems in the economy, as David says. But there is, short-term, a very strong case for, say, a jobs bill, as the president said, but the Republicans blocked another one this week. And it struck me that that many Democrats are now saying outright what they were kind of mumbling before, which is that Republicans are deliberately sabotaging the economy for the election. But on the budget cuts, if you look at what Speaker Boehner said afterward, that call for revenue increases sounded good. It sounded balanced. But then they clarified by saying he wasn't really talking about revenues as most of us understand them. He was talking about government land sales, asset fees, copays for health care. That wasn't as promising as it first looked for a deal.
But David, I wonder, are the kind of changes, the structural improvements you're talking about, do they require public investment by the government? Is there a role for Washington to bring that about?
Yes. I don't believe in the short term. I think when you've got all this delevering going on, I don't think a stimulus plan is going to do much in the short term. But you can do some fundamental things in the long term. The big infrastructure problems you can do. The human capital policies you can do. You can adjust the tax code so we have a much simpler and growth-oriented tax code. That stuff is going to take a long time to do, but we're in a long problem. And so we should use this winter of recuperation to build so when we have a spring, when we have growth, it's broad-based and it's deep.
I just want to say almost every economist, including some conservatives, disagree with David that a short-term jolt to this economy wouldn't help it. It would help it, and we could use it. And, you know, the Financial Times and other non-socialists are saying this sort of thing. And in the long run, I agree with a lot of what David's for, but as you suggested, Robert, that requires revenue.
It's just not true.
David, as they say in the debates, you've been referenced by
it's just not true every economist agrees
most,
with that.
The vast majority.
Let's leave the short-term and long-term problems of our economy aside and move on to what's really occupied the political press all week, which is Herman Cain. Who's been asked about sexual harassment complaints from the 90s and the cash payments that the National Restaurant Association made to two women who complained. David, you first. Is this the beginning of the end of the Cain phenomenon?
There was no beginning. He was a TV show that lasted for a little while. Listen, let me stand up for elitist insiders. This is a job for professionals. Running for office is a job for professionals. Governing is a job for professionals. What Herman Cain did this week, let's leave aside the harassment. His handling of this was completely unprofessional. Every amateur candidate knows how to do a better job than this. You find out the information, you lay it out clearly, and he couldn't do the ABCs of running for office. So as far as I can tell, he is what he has been, an entertaining, very likable TV show who will, when it actually comes time to cast votes, people are going to go with the only one candidate who seems plausible, and that's, I'm afraid,
for the time being, they're neck and neck in the polls.
That's because we're in the silly season. Why not in the early part of the season go for the guy who makes you feel good? It's free and it's easy.
E.J. Dionne?
I think he may end up as an entertaining television show when this is all over.
He had a radio show before it began.
Yes. I mean, I agree with David that on the lack of professionalism here. I mean, the lack of professionalism also is he kept changing his story, which is a real problem. And politically, when he started blaming Rick Perry, he was kicking away his best Rick Perry for putting out this story. He was kicking away his best opportunity, which was to blame the liberal media, which then they went back to. It does show, though, that a lot of Republicans just can't get to Mitt Romney. Romney stays there at around 23-24%. And all the other Republican primary voters shift around. Right now, they've identified Kaine. I think the guy who wishes he were still there is Tim Pawlenty. This might have been his moment if he had not dropped out.
David Brooks, does this all show there's a great weakness in Mitt Romney, that there's somebody in that number two spot giving him a good race all the time?
There's nobody in the number two spot. There are certainly weaknesses. I'm struck by the fact that a lot of people just don't like him. I remember when he ran for office last time and 4 years ago, all the other Republican candidates really got along well with each other. But when Mitt Romney would walk in one of those pre-debate green rooms, the emotional temperature would just drop. And so there's something about him. Maybe he's too perfect, too good-looking, whatever it is. And then the fact that he's from Massachusetts, a lot of people think he's too moderate. There is some resistance to him in the party. But at the end of the day, my own view is, and this week exemplifies it, no alternative.
His nomination, you figure, is just about inevitable.
Well, I hate to do that because God knows I've been wrong before, but it looks that way right now.
I agree with David on the emotional temperature and the fact the party can't embrace him. That's why I still can't see it as inevitable. Yet.
E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post, David Brooks of The New York Times, thanks to both of you. Once again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. And we begin this hour with a number, 80,000. That's how many jobs the U.S. economy added last month, according to the Labor Department. And the unemployment rate fell slightly as well to 9%. Now, while any job growth is a positive sign, NPR's Chris Arnold reports that today's number was less than most economists had hoped for. It's also not nearly enough to keep up with the number of people in need of work.
The economy averaged 114,000 new jobs a month since August, which might sound like a good thing, but there are about 14 million Americans unemployed and looking for work. Add to that population growth, and by one estimate, at this rate it would take 30 years to bring down unemployment to pre-recession levels. And speaking from the G20 summit in France, President Obama said today that this is why Congress should pass his jobs bill.
My hope is that the folks back home, including those in the United States Senate and the House of Representatives, when they look at today's job numbers, which were positive, but indicate once again that the economy is growing way too slow, that they think twice before they vote no again.
Still, there's been some progress. The number of people unemployed for more than 6 months fell pretty sharply, down by about 500,000 people. But that still leaves more than 5 million people who've been out of work longer than 6 months, and some of them much longer.
I was laid off in December of 2008 from Citibank.
Mark Hoffman is 49 years old and still out of work. He used to be in charge of some back office computer systems at the bank, and he made around $100,000 a year. We found him yesterday at the Occupy Boston protest. And his struggle over the past few years mirrors what's happened with a lot of Americans.
I've gone through my unemployment. I eventually ended up wiping out my 401k.
Hoffman says after a year or so, he just kind of gave up.
Hopelessness is a good description. It reaches a point where there is no way out.
So what Hoffman eventually did was change careers, or at least he's trying to. He's going back to school to become, of all things, a locksmith.
Locksmithing, it's a nice puzzle. I went into technology because I like puzzles and problems. Locksmithing is puzzles and problems.
And Hoffman says you can't outsource it.
There's also a lot of new technology in locksmithing. A lot of access control is card-based.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, yeah, so you could do a physical lock installation, but then also do a security swipe card.
Right.
Hoffman probably won't make as much money as he used to, but what he's doing likely makes a lot of sense. John Sylvia is the chief economist at Wells Fargo.
Many people are coming to the realization that the old job and the old location are not going to suffice, and they have to change jobs or change careers and or change location.
You can see this with retail workers. The country has lost hundreds of thousands of retail jobs since the recession hit. And with more automated checkout kiosks at grocery stores and pharmacies, and then there's all the online shopping, many of those jobs just may not be coming back. So some people who used to work in retail need to find other kinds of work. And that leads to what economists refer to as structural unemployment, people without the right skills to get new jobs or who just live in the wrong place.
Chairman Bernanke's question and answer period earlier this week, how much of this 9% unemployment is structural. From our point of view, probably 2 to 2.5% of this is structural.
Meaning that the unemployment rate would be a lot lower if job seekers had the right skills. This is why so many economists are saying that retraining and education are especially important in this economic recovery. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. You talk back to us. It's our Back Talk segment, and that's in just a few minutes, along with updates on some stories we've covered. But first, it's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. Today, we are going to go to the Bible Belt. And it's not surprising to learn that there are groups of Christians who are committed to spreading the gospel there. But what might be surprising is the focus of their ministry. Bikers. It's called the Freedom Biker Church. It now has branches in the Carolinas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Colorado, and even British Columbia, Canada. Its mission is to reach out to, quote, unchurched bikers, unquote, that is, bikers who would probably not be too comfortable walking into a mainstream church. Here is the church founder, preacher Mike Beasley.
You take Biker Bob out there, or Billy, that's got hair down to here and tattoos and old gruff, and he gets saved. Now, what do you do? Now, you get cleaned up and cover your tattoos and cut your hair and stuff, and then we'll let you come in, but you're never going to teach Sunday school. You're probably never going to sing in the choir, or what?
Or what? And Preacher Mike Beasley joins us now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Michelle, for the invitation and the opportunity.
Now, a phrase on your website struck me. It says, black leather, tattoos, jeans, proper Sunday attire.
Yeah,
okay.
That's it.
Aside from what members of your congregation are, would it be allowed or encouraged to wear? What would you say, allowed or encouraged?
You know, probably our specific is as long as you wear clothing. We don't say what kind, but it is a biker church, so it's okay to have leather, jeans, and tattoos. That's one of the probably unique things about freedom, that whole wall of expectations down, and we want you to be comfortable in who you are and in your own skin.
Now, how did you come up with the idea for this? I understand that you were a pastor in so-called mainstream churches, and I'm only using that term because I can't figure out what else to use.
Well, some people use traditional, but
traditional,
mainstream's more politically correct these days. So
okay.
I don't want to make church folks mad and say traditional.
Okay.
But yeah, 15 years, me and my wife served in mainstream traditional churches, and that's what God called us into. I surrendered to preach in 1990 and have enjoyed it the whole time for 15 years.
But you also like to ride. You and your wife also like to ride,
oh,
right?
Absolutely. We have rode motorcycles for years. And when I was pastoring mainstream church, some of the folks didn't really like for their pastor to be a biker, but he was. But, I had the cleaned up look, cut the hair, put on the suit and tie on Sundays. But, you know, I have to admit I was a little uncomfortable sometimes myself. We'd get home from church on Sunday, and the first thing we would do was off with the suit, off with the dress, put on the jeans, leathers, whatever, and we would head out.
So was it something that you kind of kept, I don't want to say hidden, but kind of kept apart from your church life, or you just didn't talk about it very much?
Well, probably. You know, it was kind of a running joke with some of our folks. I'd pull into some of our ladies, you know, visiting and stuff, and if I was on the motorcycle, it was a beautiful day, I'd cut it off in the driveway and kind of coast up because I knew if they knew I was on the motorcycle, I'd have to hear it in a sweet and kind way. But I think it depends on what generation you're from. Bikers still have still a lot of stereotyping that takes place. And so, unfortunately, you know, that still takes place somewhat in church, not just for bikers. But for us, you know, we just had a passion for the motorcycle community for some time and had been ministering and witnessing the bikers through a local motorcycle ministry for years. And the thing that seemed to be missing that the Lord put in our hearts in 2005 was that there was not a place for unchurched bikers to come and explore about, you know, a relationship with Christ and know more about the church. And so that's really what spawned Freedom Biker Church, was to just have a neutral place, a safe place that they could come and just check it out, so to speak.
I was going to ask about that. Was it a eureka moment? How did it come to you that this was the path that you should go down? Like, was it like Saul on the road to Damascus? Did you get struck?
You know, it was a, oh, my goodness, run moment. Yeah, we were actually at an event. The Lord had been dealing with our hearts about something like this, because in the biker ministry that we were in, we had an opportunity to minister to a lot of the members in that group. and other folks, and just really saw that a lot of them were having a hard time getting connected in their local church that they were involved with. People were not necessarily understanding them or wondering, you know, why do you have to be like this or ride that motorcycle or have the tattoos or long hair or whatever. And so our heart was really kind of going out, and I was a pastor, so a lot of the guys and gals would come to me or my wife and talk with us and just, you know, share some of their struggles and burdens in their own church. And so the thought was that, wow, you know, how neat it would be to have a place that they could come to, a church like this. We were having a rally every third Sunday of the month in the afternoons, and bikers would come from all over the state to this thing. And we called it Journey to Hope, and it was really incredible. And just the level of freedom, the experience that was there, and people really just loved it. And several folks would say, this would be so awesome if we could have something like this every Sunday.
It was kind of like really a rally. It was kind of like a biker rally,
exactly,
where people just kind
exactly
of get together to hang out and hear a word while they're there.
That's it. We, you know, it's a biker rally, and then the gospel breaks out. So,
you know, there is this perception that you talk about the stereotypes that people have about bikers. I mean, on the one hand, yes, the bike is associated with freedom, but sometimes people translate that love of freedom with a love of partying, hard partying, and, wildness, alcohol, drugs, that kind of thing. I just have to ask, Pastor, if you don't mind, that is there some truth to that stereotype?
Probably sure. I mean, the freedom. I think the biggest thing of the freedom is the independence. You know, the biker culture really began to grow and spawn from men coming out of the military years ago, and that's where a lot of our groups came out, and different biker clubs and stuff around the country grew out of. And so you had this whole real mentality and mindset of freedom. But yeah, there definitely is, like in any lifestyle, there can be an indulgence, too much.
You know, I have a question, though, that strikes me. Is it that alcohol is associated with biking in part because bikers aren't offered anything else to do while they're biking? Is that part of it? Is it not so much that bikers want to drink, is that drinking is accepting, whereas if other alternatives are offered,
right,
then maybe people would embrace. Well, the reason I'm thinking about that is that on your website you feature a testimonial from two of your congregants, Carmen and Mike Barber. If I could, is that okay if I play that?
Absolutely.
Okay, here it is.
Freedom Biker Church has really changed our lives. It's taught us how to live.
If any function I did, beer was involved in it, and now I've been without it, and I don't even miss it. Today's my birthday, and it's going to be my first sober one in over 30-some years.
Is that a big part of the ministry?
You know, it really is huge, and we don't promote the partaking of alcohol or whatnot. We don't also get the Bible out and beat people over the head. We allow the Holy Spirit to deal with folks' lives, just like Mike on the video. He'd be the first one to tell you. I think the biggest thing, I don't know a lot of alcoholics or drunks that go to a bar to get drunk. It's way too expensive. If you're going to get drunk, you go to the grocery store and you buy, you know, a six-pack or something or several and go home. People go to the bars and stuff because they're looking for relationships and somewhere to belong. Everybody in the world is looking for acceptance, security, significance of some kind, and a real genuine love from somebody. And when you take those components together, people end up going down certain paths or choosing certain things in life, vices or whatnot, because they're missing one of those four components or, you know, all four. And what freedom really is just taking the essence of the church, you know, relationship with Jesus Christ, and bringing that into, you know, I guess in a real sense of just pure saying, hey, here's no pretenses, no walls. You come as you are, you be who you are, and we just want to encourage you right along beside of you and whatever you're dealing with, and use the scriptures as our guide and allow, you know, the Holy Spirit in people's lives to make the change and to be that significant something in their life. And it's been an incredible journey. I mean, God called us to ministry in 1990. I've been pastoring ever since. I love it. But I love what I've seen in the last 5 years through the Ministry of Freedom Biker Church, and not just in the one in Andrew, North Carolina, the home office or the original one that started, but in all of our churches, whether it's in Vancouver, Canada, whether it's, you know, Lafayette or Mississippi, every one of them, we hear the same stories. Maybe it's different names, but it's the same stories. And people are coming and they're finding something that they describe as real, a real relationship, a real genuineness. And that's the uniqueness, I think. And I think that's also what the church really should be representing. If when we read the scriptures, that the church hung out together, they took care of each other, they supported each other, they were a real brotherhood and sisterhood. And if you look at the biker community, that's what the biker community is all about, brotherhood.
But I was going to ask you that before we let you go, and thank you for taking the time. I'm tempted to ask you what you're going to preach on Sunday, but maybe you don't want to give me a preview. But is there
Transfiguration.
Transfiguration, okay.
Shiny chrome.
Okay. I was going to say alternate fuels, maybe. I don't know. But do you think there is something that traditional churches could learn, or houses of worship, right, could learn from your experience in preaching to the biker community?
You know, Michelle, me and my wife get an opportunity still to go back to a lot of mainstream churches and share what the Lord's been doing in Freedom. And the one thing I try to share every time we go is God's called us, our slogan on our website and a lot of our material is, let's ride for Christ's sake. I believe all of us, you know, we're created in God's image. We should be doing something, you know, especially as believers, for His sake. And I think that our mainstream churches, we really need to step back and take a look at what we're doing and how we're doing it. A lot of churches are doing an incredible job reaching people in the communities, but I think that there's a lot of churches also that still have, you know, half-empty pews, and they're just not really being effective in the community. And I challenge them every time we share with this. If your church closes doors today, would your community miss it? Would the community even know the church was not there anymore? I really believe with all my heart, Michelle, that if Freedom Biker Church stopped existing today, that the biker community would really notice it and miss it, because it has made that much of an impact within the biker community. And that's something that I think all of our churches should be challenged with. Are we really making a significant impact and have an influence in our communities? For us, it's the biker community. That's our community. But for local churches or places of worship, you know, it's the community around them, the neighborhoods and so forth.
Mike Beasley is the founder and pastor of Freedom Biker Church in Anger, North Carolina. He was kind enough to join us from Raleigh. Preacher Mike, let's ride.
Amen. Thank you, Michelle. God bless you.
Dormitory life is often a little grungy, but at St. Mary's College of Maryland, building conditions were so bad, they moved some students out. The school is giving them sort of a semester at sea. Actually, the students are living on a cruise ship. It's docked in a river just off campus. NPR's Beenish Ahmed reports on this impromptu floating residence hall.
Late-night fire drills are an all-too-common part of the college experience. But instead of shrieking sirens, a couple hundred students in St. Mary City, Maryland, will hear this sound in case of emergencies. The deep tubatutes come from the Sea Voyager. It's a nearly 300-foot cruise ship that's docked just off St. Mary's Riverfront campus. The ship was brought in when two different dorms were deemed uninhabitable due to mold. Joseph Ergo is president of the small liberal arts college. He says the floating residence hall makes perfect sense for St. Mary's.
The river's a really critical part of the college's identity. So having this here in some ways is really an organic solution for us.
The St. Mary's Seahawks are known for aquatic sports. Their sailing team has won many national titles. So when a sailor alumnus mentioned the Sea Voyager was available, the college moved quickly. It was already spending around $1 million on hotels and shuttles for the display students. The cruise ship didn't cost much more. Still, the decision came as a surprise to students. They were in for an even bigger surprise when they started moving into the ship's cabins.
Hey, Mom, look how tiny it is!
Mary Beth McAndrews is a freshman at St. Mary's. At 5 feet 10 inches, her feet hang off her new bed. There's hardly enough room for two of these mini beds in the room, even without the clothes, books, and shoes she and her roommate will house here. McAndrews' mom looks for the bright side in all of this, which is quite literally the afternoon sun reflecting on the St. Mary's River. Her daughter isn't impressed.
Look at that. It's pretty.
That is pretty, but I can't live out there.
She'd prefer more space, but McAndrews is taking the experience in stride.
It's aggravating now, but in the long run, I'll be like, hey, I lived in a boat in college, and a hotel, and a dorm. I lived in three different places my first semester of college, so it's a fun story to tell people.
Down the hall, Diana Zhang is taking a first look at her cabin cubicle. She and her roommate, Catherine DeCesare, have brought only the bare minimum. Zhang says the shifts have taken a toll on her grades.
The moving in and moving out, being late for the classes, you miss the stuff which you're supposed to learn.
St. Mary's isn't the first college to charter a ship because of adverse circumstances. Some New Orleans area colleges took the same route when residence halls were ravaged by Hurricane Katrina. Anthony Lorino is a chief financial officer at Tulane University. He says the cruise ship wasn't exactly a luxury liner.
It was not paradise. It was nice, it was clean, but it wasn't extravagant.
There were no chocolate fountains or slot machines, and the bar was closed. St. Mary's Sea Voyager doesn't even have laundry machines for students to use. With limited occupancy and tight security, the Sea Voyager is unlikely to become party central. Although, St. Mary's students could prove to be as resourceful as their college's administrators. Beenish Ahmed, NPR News, Washington.
Our program is directed by Jonathan Baer, edited by Corey Turner and Franklin Cater, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson.
Our planning editors are Jerry Holmes and Julia Buckley. The staff includes Art Silverman, Rob Ballinger, Brendan Banaszak, Theo Balcom, Melissa Gray, Carol Klinger, and Abby Sykes.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we speak with a man who is making a church home for a group that hasn't always felt welcome there. Here's a hint. Proper church attire may include leather, jeans, and tattoos. And don't forget the helmet. We'll have that conversation in Faith Matters, which is just ahead. But first, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or the NCAA, recently announced major rules changes for college sports, touching everything from academics to money. The organization has come under heavy fire lately for cheating scandals across the country and for rules that some believe unfairly restrict athletes. We recently spoke with Britt Kerwin, the co-chair of the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics. That's a watchdog group. He was highly critical of the way the NCAA was policing its member colleges and universities. A few days after speaking with us, he met with leaders of the NCAA about those concerns. That group included our next guest, NCAA President Mark Emmert, and he's with us now from Austin, Texas. Mr. Emmert, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be with you.
How do you think of the rules changes that were just announced? Do you consider this a major overhaul, or do you consider just a tweak, a refinement?
Well, it is, I think, unequivocally a major shift, but it's just the beginning of a series of changes that we're in the middle of doing and need to drive through over the course of this school year. And I'm very excited about the support that the university presidents have given to these changes, and I think it's going to make a very, very big difference in the lives of our student-athletes.
Let me just describe some of the changes, and you can jump in if you don't think I'm hitting the most important ones. First of all, the conferences can vote to add $2,000 in the full cost of attendance money to scholarship offers. As most people who've had a college scholarship know, scholarships generally only include tuition, you know, room and board, and it doesn't include things like maybe going out to eat or
travel costs
and things of that sort.
And,
you know, incidentals.
The realities of life, yes.
Right. Individual schools can choose to award multi-year scholarships. Scholarships may not be revoked based on athletic performance. Schools that fail to meet the academic progress rate cut line will be ineligible for postseason play, including bowl games, and eligibility requirements increased from a 2.0 GPA to a 2.3 for incoming freshmen, a 2.5 for junior college transfers. And there are others. Of those, the one that affects the $2,000 in kind of additional scholarship money is the one that's getting the most attention. Do you think that's the most important?
Well, actually, I don't. I think easily the most important changes are those in academic requirements. But, you know, the $2,000 issue is one that I felt very strongly about, and it was highly supported by our presidents, because it does recognize that the full cost of going to school is, as you point out, greater than just tuition fees, books and supplies, room and board. And the current model has been in place for more than 40 years, and it was time that we made an adjustment to it.
Let's talk about both of those issues separately, but let's talk about the money piece first. And of course, you know, the big elephant in the room is this whole question of the billions of dollars that college sports generates, and specifically men's college football and men's college basketball. And you've said that the idea of paying student athletes for their services because it's their physical labor that contributes to those results, you're saying that's off the table, that it simply is not supported by anyone in college administration.
No, it's absolutely right. And one of the most fundamental principles of intercollegiate athletics is that these are students who happen to be athletes, not the other way around. And so when people talk about moving toward a pay-for-play model of turning students into professionals and employees of the university, we have that system in the United States. It's the NFL, it's the NBA, it's professional baseball, and that's all well and good. But the unique American tradition is to have athletics combined with universities and colleges. We're the only nation that does it. And having people be students who are participating and representing their school is one of the most fundamental notions behind what college sport is all about. And what most people don't realize is that student athletes are, in fact, better students than the student bodies overall that they're of their universities. At virtually every university in America right now with Division I sports, the athletes have higher graduation rates than the rest of the student body. And that's true whether they're men or women, regardless of race. But there's this mythology out there that, you know, student athletes are dumb jocks. They don't go to class. They don't participate in the academic world when, in fact, they do. Now, that doesn't mean they don't have other serious demands on their time. And one of the problems is that student athletes now put in, you know, 30 to 40 hours a week, and in some cases they do it 9 and even 12 months out of the year. The increase in the size of our scholarship funds, the $2,000 we're talking about, is at least in part a recognition that it is much harder for student athletes to have a part-time job. They do, in fact, have all the miscellaneous expenses that a regular student has. And so we're trying to make sure that we address some of those concerns you're bringing up.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Mark Emmert, president of the NCAA. They just announced some major changes to some of the rules governing the relationships between colleges and universities and their student athletes. What about the argument that these more stringent academic requirements really only put more pressure on the athletes, and they don't really do anything to require these institutions to support them more academically?
Yeah, what they do, though, is they shift also the responsibility to the athletic departments and to the coaches to make sure that students are keeping up with and have time for their academic work. There's not a coach in the country who wants to say to his athletic director or his president or her president that we qualified on the court or on the field this year, but we can't go to a postseason tournament or a bowl game because our grades aren't good enough. And so part of the shift is saying, look, if a team does not meet its academic eligibility responsibilities, it can't go to our tournaments, can't go to postseason play, that's going to change the dynamic in the locker room pretty significantly, because that's everybody's goal, get to go to the NCAA tournament, get to go to a bowl game.
Well, one of the things that the Knight Commission recommended that was limiting postseason play, the argument is if really the experience is about being a college student and the student-athlete experience, why not limit postseason play? What does that really add to the academic experience?
Oh, well, I think the Knight Commission is dead wrong on that. If you talk to any student athlete, even one in high school or middle school, and say, what do you want to do as an athlete? They'll say, well, I want to go to the Final Four. Well, I want to go to a bowl game. Well, I would, you know, the aspiration of playing in postseason play is one of the most important elements and opportunities for a young man or a young woman who's an athlete. And
really?
So,
really? Oh, why? I mean, and oh, do there have to be that many bowl games?
Well, the bowl games, of course, are, I guess we have 35 of them. That means that 70 teams get to participate. I've never talked to a student athlete walking off a football field who said, gee, I wish I didn't get to go to that bowl. It is something that every college football player wants. Every women's field hockey player wants to go play in the NCAA tournament. Every track runner wants to go to the Nationals and run in a track meet. And it's in large part the biggest reward they get as an athlete, not as a student, but as an athlete. One of the funnest things for them is to get to go and do those activities. It's a pinnacle of their athletic career.
There's so many things that we could talk about, and we do appreciate your taking the time. But before we let you go, I do have to ask you about this question of injuries to athletes. As you know, a hard hit can change someone's entire life. And Congressman Bobby Rush from Illinois recently had some harsh words about the NCAA. I'm sure you've heard this. He reportedly compared the NCAA to the mafia, saying, quote, "I think they're one of the most vicious, most ruthless organizations ever created by mankind." He was specifically talking about the fact that if a player gets hurt on the field, that sometimes they are left to address the implications of that on their own, that schools and some institutions have actually brought lawsuits to keep from footing those bills. And his argument is that that's actually, you know, as big of a problem as this whole question of additional scholarship money or giving kids enough money to kind of get through school comfortably. You know, aside from the rhetoric, which I'm sure you don't appreciate, what about the whole issue of athletic injuries? Are colleges and universities being fair to their student athletes if they're injured?
Sure. Well, first, let me address the rhetoric just a little bit. You know, the NCAA provides $2 billion, that's with a B, $2 billion of direct and indirect financial support to student athletes across 400,000 different student athletes. We provide more financial support for students than any organization other than the federal government. And if that's the definition of the mafia, that's a pretty strange definition in my book. But the fact is we worry deeply about student welfare and their physical safety. It's one of the reasons the NCAA was created over 100 years ago. And so we have spent a lot of time and continue to spend a lot of time on the safety of players, minimizing the impacts that that occur on them while they play their sports, while they're training. I think we do in collegiate athletics the best job of that in at any level of athletics. We have a variety of insurance programs for student athletes who get injured, both at the NCAA level and at the institutional level. We require that all student athletes are covered by an insurance program when they're playing in our sports. And
you don't think it's a problem?
I think it's an issue that we always have to be attentive to, but I think the congressman's portrayal of it is grossly inaccurate.
Before we let you go, what is your sort of overall assessment of the way student athletes are treated in general? Do you have an overarching issue that you wish you could address if you had the power to do it on your own?
Yes, mine wouldn't be about money as much as it would be about the lives of our student athletes. If I could wave a wand, I would encourage the student athletes and all of the people involved in sports to strike a better balance between the time they spend on their sports and the other opportunities that are available to them in their university and college lives. They spend, as we noted, you know, 30 to 40 hours a week working on their sports. The vast majority of that time, or at least a significant portion of it, is work that they do voluntarily, because these are very competitive young men and women. They want to be the best athletes they can, and in the process, they wind up not taking advantage of all the other things that are available in a great university that you and I probably had a chance to take part in. And I wish they would see that over the long run, of course, having a very balanced life is one that really makes great sense. And so if I could wave a wand, I'd say, great, play your sport, be competitive, go to that bowl game, go to the tournament, but don't forget to enjoy the social life and the academic opportunities that are afforded you as well.
Mark Emmert is the president of the NCAA. He joined us from Austin, Texas. President Emmert, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.